This month marks the 55th anniversary of one of the worst mass murders in Chicago history. 24-year-old Richard Speck entered a townhouse that was serving as a dormitory for student nurses and nurses working at the South Chicago Community Hospital. He systematically raped, stabbed, strangled, and murdered eight women starting about 11 p.m. and into the morning hours. One survivor hid under the bed, identified him, and based upon her courageous testimony at trial, Speck was convicted and sentenced to death. By twists and turns, he was spared the death penalty but lived out his life in Illinois prisons. What do we know about this man? Why was he capable of this level of evil? What do we know about the woman who survived this? And here to talk about the issue is one of the most foremost experts on the issue, Dennis Brio. He's an author and a journalist. He co-wrote the book with Bill Martin, a book called Crime of the Century. Excellent book. Richard Speck and the Murders That Shocked a Nation. The story on Speck murders was published in the Chicago Tribune, Sunday Magazine, and he won awards for his journalism. Thank you so much for joining us, Dennis. Thank you for joining us on WGN today.
Hello, Karen. Glad to be with you.
Let's talk about the crime itself. You know, I asked my producer, who's a young thing, he did not know anything about the crimes, and I assume that there are going to be people under the age of 30 who may not, they're not going to remember the crime, but they don't know much about it. So could you just give us kind of a little bit of a backdrop on what was going on the year, what the scene looked like, and how the crimes were committed?
Well, the year was, it was July 14, 1966. In 1966, the average salary in Chicago was about $8,000. The average car cost about $3,000. The Book of the Hour, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, could be bought for $5.95 in hardcover. There were racial riots going on over fair housing. Martin Luther King had a big rally in Soldiers Field. Nationally, Lyndon Johnson was stepping up the war in Vietnam, and protests were beginning. And, you know, the Chicago police were working double shifts, a very chaotic time, and it was also a tremendous heat wave in Chicago with temperatures in the high 90s up to 100 degrees. And it broke like a thunderstorm. And, you know, the Speck murders were really kind of the granddaddy of all the mass murders and serial killers we've had since. It's become kind of commonplace, banal today, but the Speck murders and a few years later the Helter Skelter Charles Manson murders ushered in this era.
Let's talk a little bit about, if you can just kind of give us the details of what happened that night. Who were these nurses? Where were they living? And how did Richard Speck get to be in the vicinity of these women?
Well, you know, we have three main characters in this drama. Let's start with Richard Speck. Richard Speck was a low IQ, about a 90 IQ, low life. His emotional age was about 12, but he had a PhD in criminal skills and cunning. And he had been in March of that year, 1966. He had to leave Dallas. He'd had 41 arrests in Dallas at the young age of 24. And he came to Chicago for no better reason than his sister and brother-in-law lived in Chicago up near Wrigley Field. They were tired of him, and they dumped him at the Union Hiring Hall on East 100th Street, which is about 12 miles south of the Chicago Loop. And by a really unfortunate coincidence, the South Chicago Hospital had a shortage for its nurses, and they'd rented three townhouses on that street, and one of them, the one in question where the nine nurses were, was across the street from the Union Hiring Hall. So if it hadn't been for that, Speck would have never gotten near these nurses. It was a really crazy clash of cultures. You know, you had clean-cut, committed nurses, and then you had Speck, who was a career criminal at the age of 24, and he had 3 days to observe his prey, and on the night of July 13th, he set out dressed all in black to kill.
And how did he access this? It really wasn't a dormitory. You corrected me on this. It was a townhouse that was serving as a dormitory for these student nurses and nurses who were working at the hospital. How did he access the building?
Well, he had spent the night before. He'd run out of money, and he'd actually slept on a bench in the Luella Park right behind the townhouse. And Speck always had a knife or a screwdriver on him. He was an expert at breaking and entering. Most of his arrests in Dallas were for that. and he simply jimmied the back window with his switchblade knife, reached in and unlocked the door. The nurses were asleep. In fact, Corazon Amaral, the survivor, was saying her prayers. And Speck came up the stairs, knocked in a normal manner, and things went downhill from there.
And he managed to kill all of these women. Some were strangled, some were knifed, some were raped. Tell me how he managed to do it. I mean, I'm just thinking of one man and all of these able-bodied women. How is it that they couldn't fight back, and how did he subdue them to get this job done that was just horrific?
That's what everybody thought back in 1966, including myself. I'd only been in Chicago a few weeks then. He did it. Well, one, he had a gun, a loaded gun, which he'd acquired that very day when he raped a 53-year-old barfly and stole her gun. And that, he didn't want to use the gun because he didn't want to make any noise, but that did threaten the girls. But his real secret weapon was he was a very soft-spoken Texas drawl. And the Corazon Amaral, the surviving nurse, thought he had gentle eyes, and he started out assuring them, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm not going to rape you, I just need money to get to New Orleans. And there was kind of a split. The three Filipino nurses, who were actually licensed nurses and were salaried by the hospital and were somewhat clannish, wanted to fight for their honor. They'd come from the Philippines backcountry, they'd seen bad dudes before, and they could tell Speck was up to no good. But the three American nurses who were in the townhouse at that time thought they had a drunk on their hands, and psych 101, let's humor the guy, get him out the door. And the Filipino nurses deferred to the Filipinos had only been in Chicago since the past May, only a matter of weeks. So they deferred to their American colleagues, and Speck sat him down on the floor. It was kind of like an Indian powwow, and he chatted with them and charmed them to the degree he could, and they had no sense of what was going to happen. But the next step was, there's six nurses now, a seventh nurse, Gloria Davey, who was kind of the golden girl of the class. She was president of the State Nurses Association, and the nurses had a 12:30 curfew. She had gotten engaged that night, and she'd had a steak and champagne dinner, and she came in, called the house mother, and then had she been super alert and heard the noise upstairs, she might have prevented the whole thing. But she came up, knocked on the door, Speck grabbed her, she became the seventh nurse in the townhouse, and that kind of startled Speck. He began to get nervous, and his next step was first he took them at gunpoint, and he was always pointing the gun at them and clicking it, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And he would march them up to the other bedrooms. They were all wanting to give him money, and this one would give him $3 and $5 and so on. And after that, he just took out his switchblade, took a bed sheet, stripped it into, cut it into strips, and asked the nurses, he simply asked permission, will you please put your hands out? And he proceeded to tie their hands and their ankles in very professional, very tight sailor knots, you know, looped around and tied, then looped back around one wrist, one ankle tied. And at that point, he had them, you know, they were totally helpless. And he had the run of the house. He had nothing to fear. And he proceeded from there. Well, the final step was two other nurses came in late at about 12:30, and by that point, Speck had untied one nurse, taken her to one of the front bedrooms, and had her gagged her, had her spread eagle on the floor, was about to rape her, when these two other nurses walked in, and by then, the cat was out of the bag. They were prepared to fight. Speck didn't want to shoot them, so he savagely stabbed and strangled them with their nurse's stockings.
Dennis?
And then he killed...
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. We're going to have to take a break here, and we'll come back. We're going to finish this story about Richard Speck murders. We're here with Dennis Brio on the WGN Karen County Show.
They received the horrible news that Richard Speck had killed eight nurses in this apartment, taking them one by one from the bedroom, tying them with bed sheets, either strangling or stabbing them all. Only one nurse survived, Corazon Amaral. She hid under a bed and survived the entire ordeal. Later, to crawl out on this ledge and scream to the neighborhood, they're all dead. All of my friends are dead. I'm the only one who's alive.
That is from the WGN archives. Thank you so much for that. We're here with Dennis Brio, who is the author of the book on the Speck murders called Crime of the Century, Richard Speck and the Murders That Shocked a Nation. Dennis, when we were cut off here, we were talking about the crimes, and let's get to the idea of who was this courageous woman who hid under the bed and was able to point out Richard Speck to get him convicted. Tell us a little bit about Corazon Amaral.
Well, Corazon Amaral came from a very poor family in the Philippines. She'd arrived in Chicago at O'Hare Airport that previous May, was picked up by a hospital bus, taken to her job at South Chicago Community Hospital, and then she was brought to and from the hospital in a Jeep. So her entire life was between that hospital and the townhouse. And she was incredibly lucky. She was able, while Speck was downstairs raping one of the women, she crawled backwards from her hiding place under one bunk bed, which she was pretty sure Speck had seen her, to one on the far wall, which had a blanket hanging down, which obscured her, and where Speck had previously grabbed two of his earlier victims, and he may not have been aware of it. And fortunately for her, he just lost count of the nurses, and when he did the final check, and of course, Corazon was only a sneeze or a cough or any kind of a nervous gesture away from certain death, but she survived, and thank God she did, and she got her revenge by eventually identifying Speck in court.
Dennis, tell us what happened with Speck after he committed these crimes and how he came to be arrested.
Well, he left the townhouse. It was about 4 in the morning. He walked the 30 minutes or so back to his rooming house in the Calumet Harbor neighborhood. He threw the knife, the murder weapon, into the Calumet River. He had a sip of beer or two in his nightstand, went to bed, got up the next morning, and resumed his drinking in this kind of twilight world where he was living. And he, at 10:30, and he got a TV report, and he learned that he'd left a survivor. And at that point, he began to attempt his mistake. And in the meantime, the Chicago police were on the case. A detective, burglary detective named Eddie Wielosinski, went by the nickname Willow, cracked the case in about 2 minutes. He learned that he went to a gas station. Speck had left his bags. He had thought on Tuesday he was going to get a ship to sail the Great Lakes, which would have prevented the murders, but he lost out to a seaman with greater seniority. And when he came back, he had his two bags, traveling bags, which he was very embarrassed about. He left them at a gas station, and Willow knew that the local troublemakers hung out around this gas station. He asked the attendant if he'd heard of anybody with kind of a southern accent who was complaining about missing a damn ship or an ammunition ship. And the attendant said, yes, matter of fact, there was a man with some funny tattoos and talked in kind of a funny sense. And, of course, Willow, being a former merchant marine himself, went to the Union Hall and went to it immediately. They came up. It said, rings a bell. The attendant there reached in a wastebasket, came up with the name Richard Speck. And, of course, his contact was his sister. They called him. They set up a sting to offer Speck another berth on a ship to try to capture him. And, they were on to him immediately.
So he, at some point, he tries to commit suicide. He ends up in the hospital. And there was a doctor there who noticed his tattoo. How did that play into the whole thing? They knew, at this point, they knew that he had an identifying tattoo that said, Born to Raise Hell, right?
Right. The same gas station attendant had pointed out that he noticed his tattoo on his Speck's left arm. On his right arm, he had a serpent tattoo. And the night of the murders, he wore a black jacket, long sleeves to cover the tattoo up. But now that they were on to it, but even before he showed up at the hospital, they had, through the Coast Guard photo and fingerprints, which matched from the townhouse door, the police chief, Orlando Williams, had asked the newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, to run Speck's photograph on their front page. And Speck, when he saw his own photo on the page, attempted to commit suicide. He was not as successful as he was in strangling the nurses, but he probably would have bled out had the rumors not called the police, who took him to the hospital. And at that point, he'd slipped through police dragnets about seven different times. But the doctor on duty, Dr. Leroy Smith, was scrubbing the blood off his arm, noticed a tattoo, told the nurse, "You're not going to believe this," called the police, and bingo, he was arrested.
Now, because of pretrial publicity, he was tried in Peoria. Is that true?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bill Martin, who took no chances, the prosecutor, he was only 29 years old, up against a public defender who was 53, who'd never lost a death conviction case. Bill wanted to take no chances at all, so he agreed to transfer the case out of Cook County, which had never had a transfer before, and agreed to the change of venue to Peoria.
It didn't take much to convict him and get the death sentence, did it?
Well, it took only Corazon Amaral, who, of course, had been an eyewitness. And when she testified, and, of course, the interesting thing here is she had been so terrified immediately after the murders, they thought she might go into psychosis or she might go back to the Philippines, which would have jeopardized the case. So Bill Martin put her in a witness protection program, and over 7 months he had her under police bodyguard, very slowly gained her trust, finally hired a Filipino translator who spoke her native Tagalog, and Cora gave to the translator the blow-by-blow of what had happened that night. Bill locked it in a safe, but he had the blueprint for his prosecution, and when they got to trial, it was like he would throw her a softball, and she would knock it out of the park, and she kept eye contact with the jurors, and with the aid of an FBI dollhouse, you know, kind of a reconstruction of the townhouse, she led the jurors through exactly what had happened, and they required only 49 minutes to condemn Speck to death.
He wasn't a very sympathetic character under any circumstances. With all his priors, wasn't Mr. Charming, and the crimes were just horrific. I want to talk a little bit about the aftermath. Corazon, and we only have a minute here before I have to take a break, and then I want to talk about the post-arrest, post-conviction antics of Richard Speck. But Corazon really kind of acquitted herself so well. I mean, she was offered money to give interviews, and she kind of just shunned all the public attention, didn't she?
Yeah, she was. Her courage and integrity was unbelievable. Veteran courtroom reporters said they were the best trial witness they'd ever seen. She was a blend of steel and lace, and she really won the jury over to her. And the minute she stepped down from the witness stand, walked over and pointed in Speck's face and said, "This is the man." Pandemonium. The reporters broke for their phones. Speck was as good as convicted.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking a little bit more about Richard Speck. We're here talking to Dennis Brio, who is the author of the book Crime of the Century. I highly recommend it if you like true crime. This is an excellent book. It was co-written with the prosecutor, Bill Martin, great attorney here from the Chicago area who died several years ago. Again, the book is called Crime of the Century, Richard Speck and the Murders That Shocked a Nation, available on Amazon. If you have any questions for our guest, please give us a call, 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. We're here talking to Dennis Brio, who wrote the book about Richard Speck, Crime of the Century, Richard Speck and the Murders That Shocked a Nation. Dennis, let's talk a little bit about can you just give us a little bit of more insight into who Richard Speck was? You talked about him being kind of a drifter. He had 41 arrests in Texas in a short period of time. What about his background could lend itself to this level of evil?
Well, if there's any mitigating factor, he was the youngest of eight children, and his six older siblings, ironically, were God-fearing, teetotaling, totally sterling reputations, and the difference was his mother and father had taught discipline and absolutely no alcohol, and the father died when Richard was only 6 years old, and he had been very close to his father. And then his mother, showing that love is blind, remarried a lunatic alcoholic who hated Speck, abused Speck, and that might have contributed to Speck dropping out of school at age 16. He caught in with a older crowd, which, you know, did a lot of tattoos, chased a lot of women, got into a lot of fights, etc. And he developed, you know, while Bill Martin was developing his legal skills, Richard Speck was developing his criminal skills. And, he, as we discussed, he had 41 arrests. He was an expert at breaking and entering. He was a born liar and knew how to lie his way out of trouble. And he had a hatred against the world. I mean, he'd failed at all the tests of maturity. He had dropped out of school. He'd actually been married and divorced. He couldn't hold a job. And the night of the murders, he was really at his, he just was a gathering storm ready to break and ready to hit back. And that's what he did that night.
He typical sociopath. I mean, he's got all the signs are there for being a sociopath. And did he, can you talk a little bit about, he really didn't give many interviews. And what did he say? Did he ever confess to the crime?
Well, he finally did in a roundabout way. He was in 1988. He had the cunning of an alley rat, and to protect himself, he traded sex for protection with the black gang members who ran Stateville Prison in Joliet at that time. I mean, the inmates were running the asylum. And Speck, the inmates kind of cooked up a scheme to pay their lawyer. They did a interview with Speck. One of Speck's lovers held the camera. The other one asked the questions, and it was kind of a semi pornographic film with Speck in panties, and he'd been on hormones and sprouted breasts. You know, you could smuggle these things into the jail at the time, including cocaine. And anyway, one of the questions was, "How do you feel about what you did?" And Speck said, "If you're asking if I'm sorry, no." And the next question was, well, how did it all happen? And Speck just very coldly replied, it wasn't their night. So he was totally remorseless, but he did, this pornographic video did serve two purposes. One, it led to prison and reform in Illinois. And two, Speck made a flat-out confession, which before he had attributed that he'd blacked out on drugs and had no idea what he was doing, which, of course, was a total lie.
And I remember Bill Curtis brought that to the public's attention. He wasn't responsible for that, taking that film, but he did bring it to everyone's attention. I think he gets associated with that, the great Bill Curtis.
Yeah, the grandiose plans for it fizzled, so the attorney gave it to Bill Curtis. It had been filmed in 1988 and in 1996 during Sweeps Week. Bill Curtis ran it on his TV show in Chicago and also nationally on A&E. And it sounded as if Speck was mocking the world from the grave, you know, speaking from beyond the grave in this video. But it was so repulsive that when they showed it to the Illinois State Legislature, you know, when they got to the point where Speck was about to perform oral sex on one of the inmates, the legislator said, you know, we've seen enough. You know, we're going to put an end to this.
And so let's go back a little bit and talk about why he wasn't executed. He got the death sentence. It took the jurors less than an hour to go back and give him the death sentence. And then what happened that allowed him to live his natural life?
Well, let me say, if anybody ever deserved the death sentence, it was Richard Speck. But he escaped it because first Supreme Court ruled that potential jurors who opposed the death penalty were excluded from jury selection. So that bought him a little bit of time. And the next year, in 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional. And then Speck lived out the rest of his life in Stateville and died of a heart attack at the age of 49 in 1991.
You know, Joliet Prison has tours, and they're very, very interesting. I took my listeners on a private WGN tour about a month ago. I highly recommend to everybody to take these tours. They're fascinating, and the tour guides have really interesting stories that were coming back from the history books and from some of the wardens and some of the guards themselves. But one of the stories, and Dennis, we haven't spoken about this, but one of the stories is that there was a hospital in there, like some sort of medical clinic where people would go when they were sick inside the prison. And a lot of the prisoners had jobs, menial jobs in the prison. And for some strange reason, Richard Speck was put into that medical facility and worked with the nurses there until the nurses said, you know what, we really don't want to work with this guy. Is that a true story? Because that's what we were told.
I had not heard it, but I assume it's possible. I mean, Speck basically became a painter. I also had a tour of Stateville, and as we were going through all the different locked doors, Speck came out pushing his little painting cart and, you know, with the vest on and his painting outfit. And I said to, the official, that's him. And he said, yes, it is. He said, but, he ain't nothing. And, we you know, Speck never did give any interviews. But I had not heard that story, but it's certainly possible.
And I guess I want to talk just briefly about the surviving nurse, Corazon Amaral. What happened to her, and what was the rest of her life like? She's still alive, and tell me about this is maybe a little bit of a happy ending on this one.
Yeah, she and Bill Martin became best friends forever, and in 1969, Bill helped her get permanent residency status in the U.S. She was an intensive care nurse. She married an attorney from the Philippines, and they lived in the Washington, D.C. area, where she worked at George Washington Hospital. And she became, in time, she had herself, her immediate family, and her relatives. There were 100 of them living very happily in Virginia. And she bought a vacation home with her husband in Las Vegas. And this is kind of interesting. When she was in the witness protection program, she would play penny ante poker with her police bodyguards. And in Las Vegas, she would never miss a chance to go into a casino with her husband and play penny ante poker. And win or lose, she always had a smile on her face because, as she said, you know, every day I wake up, I thank God for saving my life.
Fascinating. Let me just talk about the book. Can you tell our listeners how to get your book, the name of the book, and what they can expect in reading the book if they're interested in this?
Well, the easiest way is on Amazon. You can get it on the Kindle, or you can get the paperback. It runs 516 pages. A big part of it we haven't been able to discuss here involved the machinations at trial and the many gutsy moves Bill Martin had to make to get a death sentence that would stand up to appellate review. And there were a lot of twists and turns. The biggest concern was Cora herself, and she was very fragile psychologically, and to keep her, psychologically sound. And she said all she wanted to do was honor the memory of her classmates and bring Speck to justice, and she absolutely delivered on that. And so it ended up good did triumph over evil. Cora lived a very happy life, still is in America, and Speck is long gone.
And the book is Crime of the Century, Richard Speck and the Murders That Shocked a Nation. Author Dennis Brio co-wrote the book with the prosecutor, Bill Martin. Dennis, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I thank you for your insight into this horrific crime that still is something that is of great interest here in Chicago.
Well, thank you for having me, Karen.
All right. Take care.